It was only in the 60s that there was any kind of expansion of higher education in the first place, right? We think these things are now permanent because it's what we remember. But actually, most of these things are really, really recent. So we can remember or imagine a world not that long ago that was entirely different. So we must be able to imagine a world to come that is entirely different.
I'll say this, you may have nominally exited the left, but I don't think you've exited your radicalism.
Really?
I mean, you're
I constantly have these sorts of dreams of depriving the state of its purpose, which is apparently just to kind of dissolve ties and to, I don't know, make people dependent on this bureaucratic machine. It's like, we don't want that ultimately, I think. I very much dislike the state, Mary, and I always have.
Hello and welcome to Socrates in the City. I'm Mary Harrington, and I have the privilege to be joined today by Nina Power, an author, a philosopher, and patient zero, possibly, in contemporary cancel culture. Nina, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Mary.
Nina, the first time I met you was in a garden party at the Bruderhof in South London, in Peckham. And we were gathered with a very eclectic group of people, some of them Christians, some of them in this unusual group of very communitarian Anabaptists who live sharing everything in common in these Christian communities around the world, but with an outpost or an inpost, perhaps, in Peckham. And there was a very unusual mixture of people there, some historians, writers and thinkers, and obviously a lot of Bruderhof community members there. And I think that was the first time I met you. And we commiserated on how few women there seemed to be with our particular little shared set of interests. And you and I have been pretty much friends ever since, I think, mm-hmm. Part of the... So I guess there's a kind of inside baseball feel here, and we're going to have to do our best not to share too many of our running jokes, or perhaps we should share our running jokes. I don't know. But Nina, I wanted to think about that little petri dish of Christian curious, question asking, vaguely wondering whether liberal politics is all that, and that little milieu, and how you ended up in that little milieu. And how you feel it's developed since we first met at that garden party?
Yeah, sure. I mean, so my background is in philosophy. So in the 90s, I got a BA and an MA and a PhD in the early 2000s. And I was a philosophy lecturer for a long time. So in principle, I should be well set up to contemplate difficult ideas. I'm obviously very pro-dialogue. I do podcasts all the time. And I do think that this is like very important. And I think this used to be a kind of almost leftist position to be interested in free inquiry, free speech, freedom of association, freedom of conscience, and so on. And then I suppose it sort of stopped being a leftist position somehow. And I think that there were various things that started to become kind of dogmatic assertions or axioms of what it meant to be leftist that I could no longer kind of go along with, even though I was sort of more like, well, maybe redistribution is a good idea and maybe class is important and that kind of leftist, right, beforehand. And I think sort of slowly there's been this kind of insight into the kind of nihilism of the sort of materialist liberal worldview. So people come at it from all different angles, right? It might have been COVID, it might have been the lockdowns, it might have been sexual difference, you know, people insisting that that wasn't an important or central reality. Or it might be, you know, being a Christian, right, in a world, in a liberal world that is set up to promote kind of individual desire that is very inverted from a Christian point of view. So, yeah, I don't know. I guess I fell foul of a few issues.
So what were the particular issues? Tell us the story of how you fell off the leftist wagon.
I guess, I mean, I was very involved in sort of freedom of speech and freedom of association things. So like the right to protest. So the huge student protests in 2010. I'd only just graduated then from my PhD. And I was very committed to the idea of free education for everybody, right? Perhaps on the basis of like a kind of exam, right? But I really thought that because I'd gone to like a normal state school, and it was very obvious to me that there were people who were intelligent enough to go to university, but didn't go on the basis of kind of class, you know, and culture. And then when I got to university, there are people who'd gone to private school who were like manifestly less intelligent than people I'd gone to state school with. And so I had this kind of slightly one room removed chip on my shoulder, being a rural middle class person who nevertheless gone to like a normal school, as 93% of people in this country do. So I was kind of very motivated by access to university, right? And I thought it should be free for people who, you know, were able to go. And so, yeah, then lots of people got arrested in the student protests and so on. So I was very involved in trying to stop people going to prison, basically, and defending the right to protest as a kind of human right, if you like. And then about sort of 2013, 2014, I'm not sure, as a consequence of like Americanisms, identity politics, the internet, certain ideas started kind of coming in that were far less to do with like the old left, which used to have ideas like meet people where they are, right? Which is actually a very open-minded thing to say. And that, you know, if you have a better argument, you should convince someone of it, right? But the point would be to have dialogue with as many people as possible, much more like Socratic left, I guess. And then it sort of stopped being about that. And then it sort of became about people being hysterical about their identity and saying that everyone had to go along with things that were manifestly mental. So I decided not to go along with them, although I laughed, but it was very painful, because actually, you know, having freedom of conscience and thinking for oneself can be really, really painful if you're in a situation in which everyone around you or the culture or even the law starts to say things that are at odds with what you know to be true. So it's actually a struggle. And I think in every regime, like, most people are conformist, you know, whatever the set of ideas are, right? Most people will go along with them because they don't want to lose their job, they want to keep their friends, they want an easy life. But I think for some perhaps slightly strange people, saying what's true is more important than worldly things, if you like. So I eventually said, hang on a minute, I don't think this gender stuff makes any sense.
And so it was the gender stuff particularly which...
But I was kind of falling out with people on the left in London for a while. Like, no one would talk to me about these things, right? I just got kind of blank wall faces, like, can I talk about this? No, you can't. Okay. And yeah, other things, I suppose. I started to feel a bit less sure about higher education, in the sense that I actually do think it should be for maybe about 7 to 10% of people, 7 to 9% of people, but it should be open to everyone from every background, but it should only be for people who can think at that level. What it actually became with the fees, so I'm actually still against the fees, but for very different reasons, what it became was a kind of sort of Ponzi loan scheme for 18-year-olds who were basically then also kept out of the workforce. So it was also a kind of economic measure. It was an economic measure all the way down. So now you have people who are graduating with 50, 60K of debt or more even in this country and more elsewhere, who don't know anything. And they've become sort of completely ideological as well in the main. So they're terrible. They're like kind of madrassas for like absolute nonsense. And debt making machines. And then you have a kind of way too many people who think they're intelligent and think that they can judge the working class and tell other people what to think when they can't and they don't know anything. So I would keep the universities for strange people who are obsessive about truth. And that's it. That's who, and they should be free. But it's for a much smaller number of people, percentage of the population.
One of the things I wonder about a lot, and any time I think about this question of who universities are for and to what, you know, and the scale of it, is how you are, like, let's say we wanted to unwind the situation we were in, how would you actually go about doing it? Because I mean, this is I remember looking at this a few years back and realizing that most of the locations in the UK, at least, I don't know about elsewhere, but in the UK, most of the locations which have really flourished under the higher education boom since Tony Blair brought the fees in the early aughts, are also locations which used to be major industrial centres and are no longer major industrial centres. And I realised with this sort of mounting sense of horror that if you were serious about unwinding the higher education Ponzi scheme, which I agree with you is functions effectively as a kind of Ponzi scheme where the value of what's being learned goes down in proportion to the number of people attempting to learn it and the inflation in the cost of trying to do that, If you seriously went about unwinding the higher education Ponzi scheme, you would be effectively deindustrializing all over again. It would be punching the bruise of a number of parts of the country which are already in not particularly good shape as a consequence of the loss of manufacturing over the course of the mid and late 20th century. And I think we all look at the sort of sociocultural and increasingly political catastrophe which this is leaving in its wake in terms of young people feeling unable to get started in life. I think it's very likely that it's exerting a drag on family formation. Mm-hmm. It's certainly exerting a drag on people's ability to get started in life, get going in a job. Not to mention, the ideological madrasa stuff, which you've sort of fallen foul of in a personal way. All of these things are real. But if you cut off the spigot tomorrow and just said, okay, that's it, no more money, it would be absolutely calamitous. And I don't really blame every politician who sort of grudgingly kept it going and kicked the can down the road for just not wanting that to happen on their watch.
Sure, I think we're maybe at an interesting point though, where if you asked people in Britain, like, would you rather live in a poorer country that had different values that you went along with, I think they'd probably say yes at this point. So it would require basically the collapse of multiple institutions, the total refounding of the economy. I mean, I would say if we basically had a sort of staggered deportation, far fewer people here, a return to kind of artisanal work, right? So a lot of these places could go back to being technical colleges, which is a lot of them were. If you think about what happened to a lot of the secondary universities, they were originally technical colleges. So we could basically, we'd have to, yeah, everything would have to change in a way, right? Someone would have to bite the bullet, basically not kick the can down the road and say, right, okay, let's try this. Who's in, right? We rebuild the country. We do it this way. You know, people will have to take work that maybe they think is beneath them, but it's not beneath them. I mean, like,
it's not just about people taking work which is beneath them, though. We're talking about the economies of entire cities. I mean, if you think about the number of people whose livelihood depends on property portfolios in towns with high student footfall, you think about all of the ancillary businesses and the economy, which is basically being powered by borrowed money, which is being fire hosed into economies through the higher education loans system, and you think, If you turned all of that off, it would be a human level catastrophe. And I mean, I'm not saying that it wouldn't, in some abstract mm-hmm. sense, be desirable to unwind the higher education Ponzi scheme. I suppose I'm just acknowledging that it would be a human level catastrophe, and perhaps we shouldn't underestimate how grave a decision that would be, and what a messy process it's going to be when, because I think it is a when, not an if, when mm-hmm. that finally happens, and how politically unpredictable the consequences of that are going to be.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, but I think, you know, as it stands, you're going to have fewer foreign students coming in. I mean, that's also a kind of form of corruption, to be honest, where you're taking in students who can't speak English, but they have money, right? Which is a lot of what the universities are doing. I mean, look, the money is running out. The money for the welfare system is running out. The money for everything is running out, right? You can't just keep prolonging this. I mean, it's usury. I mean, capitalism is usury, right? But usury is wrong. So, you know, at some point, right, we have to roll things back. I don't think everything has to be disastrous. I think there are kind of slow ways of doing things that need to be done. I mean, it was only in the 60s that there was any kind of expansion of higher education in the first place, right? We think these things are now permanent because it's what we remember. But actually, most of these things are really, really recent. You know, so we can remember or imagine a world not that long ago that was entirely different. So we must be able to imagine a world to come that is entirely different.
I'll say this. I'll say this. You may have nominally exited the left, but I don't think you've exited your radicalism at any point.
Really? And,
no. I mean, you're very, very clearly as enthusiastically radical as yeah. And it's possible that you exited the left because it just stopped being radical in a sufficiently satisfying way.
Well, maybe. I don't know. I mean, I think there are like questions about value and what we value, right? That go beyond money. I mean, if you ask people ultimately, what do you care about, right? They will say, my family, right? My husband, my children, my relatives, my friends, where I live, right? None of that involves money immediately, right? Money is not the most important thing in that equation, right? So if there are ways of kind of living together. I mean, you know, look, the welfare state. I mean, what do you think of this? It's like the welfare state has taken away all of the things that the church and the community used to do. I mean, it's deprived people, in fact, of a relationship to the local environment, right? Like, think about a family or a village. Like, if you had someone who needed looking after, right, without a state, right, what happens? And people look after each other. You know, the state becomes this sort of impersonal behemoth, which is, you know, goes on forever and sort of starts to appear over and above us, you know, and I think for a lot of people has taken the place of husband, family, community, church, and all those things.
In my gloomier moments, I suspect that that's a Ponzi scheme which is going to unravel roughly concurrently with the with the state-funded higher education one, and for probably very similar reasons.
Well, and the welfare state. I mean, it's unsustainable. You can't have a country in which the productive people who are paying tax and are getting increasingly annoyed about it are funding people who don't make any profit at all. They just live off the state, right? That's and in increasing numbers, right? That surely can't work economically.
Not as the population pyramid, not as the proportion of net contributors shrinks beyond a certain point.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's a bumpy ride that we're already on. Mm. If we just go back to the university for a moment, I wanted to think a little bit more about the what was your turn of phrase? Strange people who are more interested in truth than anything else. Mm. Which those people are real. I mean, yeah, and there aren't very many of them. Yeah. And perhaps once upon a time that was the academy. One of the things that I've noticed, and that I think is it goes to one of the sort of long, bigger picture questions around what's happened to the academy, which is sort of, we should pick up on the theme of managerialism later on. But one of the things that I've noticed and found most interesting, and the, since I left university, or really since I began university, is the sense that's a class of people which has been more or less deliberately managed out.
Yeah.
Of universities. I mean, really managed out of any sort of major contribution in sort of high status society, with very few exceptions. I mean, Elon Musk is probably the exception that proves the rule, in that he's sort of as merrily disagreeable, extremely focused on excellence, and just bucks all of those trends. But by and large, people who are unusually interested in truth, and possibly a little on the disagreeable and obsessive side with it, have been expelled from the academy. And one of the things I found really intriguing is that somewhat thanks to the internet, but partly just because, you know, nerds will find each other and nerds will out, those people are regrouping in kind of feral formations and recreating little sort of feral academies. And I wondered if you could tell me about your experience of that, and where you see any signs of hope, or any reason for optimism among those sorts of social formations which are forming around the margins.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, that's never going to stop. I mean, people's curiosity and intellectual commitment is everlasting, right? You're always going to have this sort of type of person, one hopes. But I do agree that in the mainstream, they've been punished to hell. I mean, they've really, like, in terms of like not being employed or not getting the place they should have at university and so on. I mean, it's like, I mean, there's a sort of sinister project, I would say, to get rid of people who are disagreeable and to medicalize them and to pathologize them and to exclude them from polite society, which now consists of not telling the truth and lying all the time. And I feel really bad for people who can't but speak truthfully or awkwardly, or can't internalize the sort of nonsense social rules and laws. So, I mean, they should be in the academy. But outside of it, I think people, yeah, exactly. People are doing this, right? We're doing it at Verdurin in East London. Like, my friend Pierre is opening up. We're having like teaching and events, and I'm teaching there, and I've taught adult education, right? There are lots of situations where people are there simply to learn, if you see what I mean, right? Because that's what they want to do. It's not for anything other than the love of the subject or love of learning itself. I think, you know, canny tech companies are basically now saying to smart people, don't go to university, just come and work straight for us and you'll learn everything on the job. I mean, that's what I would do if I was a canny tech villain. I would be like, yes, okay, we need all these people, you know, and they've
got
the money.
I do actually know one canny tech, very senior leader who told me that his firm has an explicit hiring policy of they filter for people who are truth seeking,
yeah.
And that's one of the criteria, along with being freakishly clever. One of the qualities they filter for is truth seeking. And I forget what the term was that he used, but he told me that they also have an assessment as well for how annoying that person is to work with as a consequence of being maximally truth seeking. I don't know. Sometimes I sort of think mournfully about, you know, 19th century. I kind of romanticize 19th century academia as a place where it was actually possible to be one of those people and to be actually really quite annoying and also maximally truth seeking. I have no idea if it was actually like that or whether academic politics has just always been this
horrible. I think far fewer people, and the ratio of men to women would have been something like 100 to 1 or 50 to 1. So you'd have a world where, I mean, I don't know, I was thinking of like Bletchley Park and things like that, right? Where you'd have a male to female ratio. It was like the vision of what was going on would be male dominated completely, but there'd be a few sort of brilliant, unusual women. But it wouldn't be 50-50, and it wouldn't be more women than men, which is what it is now in many departments.
And in your view, that affects the social dynamics in some ways which run counter to truth-seeking?
Yeah, I mean, it clearly does. I mean, Helen Andrews wrote that piece about the feminization of the workplace recently. And I mean, I think the roots are deeper because I think it's also to do with technology and the Industrial Revolution and so on. Like, I'd give a much more historical argument. But I do think, yeah, I mean, women are generally predisposed to socialize to be nice. You know, they don't like being disliked. So it's quite, you know, what does that mean in practice? It means sort of not telling the truth sometimes, I suppose, because it's mean.
Do we really think it's true that women are more predisposed to not tell the truth because they don't want to be mean? Or I mean, I think you can probably make the case that there are equivalent social pressures on men, for example, to fall in line with an authority figure. I think would probably, you know, don't disobey orders. Mm-hmm. Would probably be the male coded equivilent of.
But that takes a lot of training. This is why training exists. This is why boys go to Cubs and Scouts and the army when they do, you know. It's like, it's not natural to be obedient in that way. Like, it takes a lot of training. Well, I don't know. I mean, well, how do we understand what's happening at universities and in terms of the ideological, where is this ideology coming from and who is enforcing it, right? We are surrounded by ideas around HR and Karens, and, you know, I mean, actually Karens are quite good because they're sort of holding people to their job and saying you should do your job properly.
Yeah, I feel like I want to speak up in defence of the Karen. I think, but you and I are kind of on the same page about
it. Yeah.
There's a positive societal case for the Karen. But the Karen, though, you know, if we're going to talk sort of crass, vaguely misogynistic internet archetypes, the, yeah, Karen and the HR executive are like, there's some Venn overlap in that diagram, right? But they're not quite the same
thing.
They're
not quite the same person.
You know, I demand to see the manager is not the same as I am the HR manager.
No.
I mean, I agree with you that something seems to be happening whereby it's become increasingly difficult to distinguish university administrative bureaucrats from the people that they're supposedly administering. You know, obviously not all academics. Hashtag. You know, I've met some who are clinging on by their fingernails. You know, to state my own stake, such as it is in this whole question. I remember, in my final year at university, I was in a tutorial with my head of English, and some guy kind of poked his head round the door and said, "Hello, do you want to go for a drink later?" to my tutor. And then after he left, my tutor turned to me and said, that guy was a student of mine about 10 years ago. And he's gone off, he's become a lawyer, he's very successful, he's having a great life. And now 10 years ago, I would have said to you, Mary, that you must do graduate work because you're obviously able and you'd write a really good PhD. And now I say to you, do not do this. You work hard, get your first and shove off, because it's a dog's life in academia. I can see what's coming, don't do it. Mm. I took his advice, and I think it took me best part of 20 years to find a niche for myself where I can basically do what I always thought academics do, which is to say, be left alone to read books all day and then teach very, very engaged students for 1 week a year. That's approximately what my life is like now. And apart from that, I just spend the rest of my time reading whatever it is that I want, and which is what I imagined my academic life was like. When I compared notes with a Cambridge Don on this fairly recently, it was like, no, that's not what academic life is like. That really, really, really isn't what academic life is like. So I sort of feel like, you know, I mean, I think I possibly did dodge a bullet there. And there are a lot of people who are kind of under this very this regime, which really isn't that. Why is this so? Is it really just a Ponzi scheme that nobody knows how to stop? Is that, you know, what's the utility of producing these? What's the economy within which people like that are continue to be desirable? You know, what is that? I mean, is this really just about managerialism become sort of metastasizing to the point where nobody knows how to stop it? You know what?
Partly. I mean, I think it's cynical in the sense it's like, well, we don't have to give jobs for people for 3 years. And we know that people with large amounts of debt have much lowered expectations for their lives because debt is depressing of itself.
Yeah.
So people will accept worse jobs. I mean, basically having a degree, particularly an arts and humanities degree at this point, does not put you in any better position.
It didn't when I got my first either, for what that's worth.
So like, why would you do it at this point? I mean, given also, like, the positive side of the internet is if you have an interest, you can pursue it to your heart's content, and you can even find people who want to actively talk to you about it in a way that's not hidebound by bureaucracy, fees, you know, piece of paper, all that. So
one tiny positive signal that I saw that I noticed the other day was a report in the press that one of the Cambridge colleges has explicitly set about abandoning its previous policy of deliberately penalising independent school students because it was driving such a brain drain that they were genuinely worried about their ability, their academic integrity. You know, in a sense, they'd sort of bottomed out on the idea that absolutely anybody could be put through this process and the product would be the same, and have returned
of course it's
to
not
a
true.
Much more.
I mean, you know, but intellectual capacity is like a small and strange thing, and it doesn't mean it's better than anything else. I mean, you know, my brother is a plumber and an electrician and a builder and has a family and is far more useful and beautiful and brilliant than I will ever be, you know. He has skills that people want, and he's very, very good at it, right? And why would you have a society that didn't value people being good at whatever their job was? You know, I think the kind of the symbolic economy, the sort of shift from, you know, kind of industrial work and manual work to the valorization of symbolic work by symbolic work people themselves, who are idiots, frankly. You know, it has nothing to do with the real value of work, right? So if we had a society that basically valued everybody for what they did, and then we could say, well, yes, you know, she is a good mother, he is a good father, he is a good builder, she is a good teacher, like, that's a good world, right? Where everybody has value in the thing that they are doing, rather than a kind of mass overproduction of symbolic manipulators who don't really know what they're doing, but think they're somehow better than the working class, which is what we currently have. That's what the middle class is. That's what the university graduate is.
It's sort of difficult to say whether it's a cause of deindustrialization or an effect of it.
It's an effect of it. It's an effect of it. But deindustrialization is a political decision.
But I mean, the proliferation of university, is it, does it precede or is it roughly concurrent with deindustrialization, historically speaking? It was already the major government, I remember, in the 1990s, which I suppose is, in that case, it probably is roughly concurrent with deindustrializing the country. That, you know, there was then this huge push to force people into knowledge economy jobs because there was that genuine conviction that we didn't have to make anything; we could just make abstract symbolic value.
Yeah, and they tried to push this with Cool Britannia in the 90s with fashion and art. But the problem is, it's like you have to have a culture that you maintain for people to be attracted to it. You can't just flood the place with people from everywhere and you know, imagine that the culture itself will carry on. Of course it won't. A culture comes from a people and a place. It's not just a memory of something. You know, it's all just so cynical. I just, you know, I think just let them all fold and then we can rebuild them. It's fine. No, and like, you know, people could rebuild the country. Like, I constantly have these sorts of dreams of everybody sort of cleaning up the streets together and, you know, depriving the state of its purpose, which is apparently just to kind of dissolve ties and to, I don't know, make people dependent on this bureaucratic machine. It's like we don't want that ultimately, I think. I very much dislike the state, Mary. and I always have.
So you're very much a sort of small Britannia.
Well, I think it's like a little
Englander in the genuine sense, not in the... Oh.
I suppose so. I mean, in the sense that I think that particular places, like the beauty of particular places. I mean, I grew up in Wiltshire, which has extraordinarily singular places, right? It is a very, very specific place with prehistoric sites. It has a very particular atmosphere, as everywhere does in this country, but it belongs to itself, right? And, you know, the people I went to school with who are local to, well, you know, that's where they are. That's where they're from. The graveyards are full of their ancestors. You know, to grow up in that kind of place, it's like, I mean, that is what place is. And I think, I don't know, that just the impersonal kind of almost like atemporal nature of the state just terrifies me. And I think we all saw this in the lockdowns, how that state machinery, that apparatus, like they see the world. The state vision of the world is like a prison, really. It's like people are just numbers. They're just nodes or lines on a spreadsheet.
This is that anarchist sociologist, isn't it? The seeing like a state guy.
But I think it's like
the idea that everything must be forced into lines and rows.
This is what bureaucracy
to make it legible.
Yeah. And then you start doing it to people and populations, and then you're like, oh well, maybe we should just kill off some of these people. They're not making us any money, right? Which is where we're at with the death bills, and you know, this is the terror of it. Like
this is also the Renaud Camus argument about replacism as an ideology. You know, to be clear, this is not some sort of smoky backrooms conspiracy theory about ethnicities, but replacism as an ideology of humans as interchangeable units within a larger economic machine.
Sure.
As it were, the sort of industrialization of humans as fungible units.
No, but we're not. I mean, it's like, you know, if I went to Japan and suddenly demanded that, like, Shinto stop, like, being so dominant because I didn't like it, and that I was just as Japanese as the Japanese people. I mean, it's mental.
I mean, it's obviously, like, absurd. I mean, this is probably a good opening moment for us to talk about the internet, both as a vector of that ideology and as possibly a means of destroying it. Because I mean, when I think about the internet, I think it's the sort of thing that would inevitably have. I mean, digital technologies are the kind of thing that would inevitably have been invented by a people keen on legibility and you know, computability and wanting to improve their capacity to see like a state. I mean, I think that's the sort of sociocultural context within which Alan Turing and the other early innovators of the computer were thinking was wanting to be able to increase the computability and the legibility and the manageability of those things within the context of industrial society and its preoccupations, and then this technology develops and it does that. I mean, in a sense, none of COVID could have happened without what the internet provided as a supposed alternative to all of those moments of human connection and localism and individual social linkage. You know, the fact that it was possible to deliver a kind of a simulacrum of the Eucharist via Zoom was offered as consolation for the fact that all the churches were shut down.
Not my church, that's
interesting. but by and large they did. I mean, there are so many other instances of, you know, things which were supposedly where a digital alternative was supposedly substitutable.
Yeah.
Even though everybody intuitively sensed that in fact this was not a like for like substitution. I mean, the idea that you can Zoom school a four-year-old is so beyond bonkers that it's difficult even to know where to start with how angry that idea makes me and how angry that category error makes me. And yet, you know, that's what happened. And then we've come out the other side of that and everybody has basically just gone insane to the point where actually just nobody's willing even to contemplate the possibility of that kind of global replacism anymore. Not in the same way. You know, there's in a sense, everything, a lot of the governing sign of a lot of the political turmoil which has emerged since COVID has been this sort of almighty population, you know, pretty much planetary level backlash against the idea of infinitely interchangeable, fungible humans.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the tensions of universality. I mean, Christianity obviously has this too, in a sense, right? Like, in principle, everyone can be Christian, and everybody is God's creature and everybody has a soul, but it doesn't mean there aren't nations.
Yeah, I think this is a tension I think about a lot. You know, the old covenant was never revoked. You know, and God, it says, you know, but I think it's all the way back in Genesis that God created man in his nations. You know, and those nations have continued to exist. So it's not as though peoples are not a real thing. And yet also the Holy Spirit is for everybody. And that's also very clear in the Gospels. And I think it feels to me as though there's a tension there which would benefit from being more explicitly addressed as things stand in the current moment by people who are better qualified to do theology, certainly, than I am.
No, sure. And I think I speak to a lot of people who are thinking about this question, to be honest. And also I think the relationship between Christianity and Islam. I mean, what is the relationship between these two major monotheistic religions, and what obligation do Muslims have to us and we have to Muslims, for example? And what are the really obvious differences and tensions between these two religions and between countries that were pagan, Christian and liberal, but were never Muslim? You know, who now have increasing numbers of Muslims living in them, right? And this is not, this is a serious question. And I think if people don't want to understand, or they don't want to think about the fact that people really do have different beliefs and they really do have like strongly different visions of the world, then it's actually kind of disrespectful. Like, there are differences among populations in belief and culture. Like, there really are. Like, Christianity is not Islam, for example, right? It's very important to understand that there are differences, right? And they may not be compatible. I think we've this kind of like attempt to sort of make everything like the fancy of the liberal subject, who is you just move someone somewhere and that they immediately adopt to the place they've moved to. Like, this is clearly not true. Like, why would it be true? You know, I mean, like, again, if I moved to Japan, what would I suddenly know how to be Japanese and do everything in a Japanese way? Of course I wouldn't. It's like disrespectful of genuine human difference to think that everybody can be the same, or that everybody's in principle the same. Like,
but of course, the moment you start thinking that through in at any sort of level of granularity, you realize that it's an ethical and a political problem as well as a sort of abstract idea. I think I'm trying to remember the name. I think it's called The Age of Neutralizations and Depoliticizations, an essay by Carl Schmitt, written some time ago now, almost 100 years ago, where he is a German jurist. He's a little bit problematic to talk about because he did spend a certain amount of time as a member of the Nazi Party. So, like, you know,
he's a great theorist.
Right, I mean, and difference, like, is good. But in a sense, it comes from that fantasy that we can find somewhere to stand, and that there exists even somewhere to stand within which we can just dissolve all differences and somehow escape the political as being a fact of life.
That just seems like Death Drive. It's like the oceanic. It's like, you know, what if we could make everything smooth and we were asleep? Yeah. I mean, like, okay.
Yeah, right. It sounds horrendous to me as well. But and yet there are a huge number of people who find that genuinely appealing. And just sort of bringing this back to the COVID that we were discussing and that very strange moment, which I really do think we should talk about more. You know, I mean, there were lots of people, you know, it got very polarised very quickly at the time. But I feel like there hasn't been nearly enough reflection yet on just how utterly bizarre all of that was. And it seemed to me at the time that the COVID dream, the sort of such as it was that we could use technology, that we could use the internet as a kind of giant automated sort of techno mother who would neutralize all of those political issues and somehow leave us swimming in your sort of, what was it, you'd make everything smooth and we'd all be asleep. So we're all just like Neo in his pod in The Matrix, sort of swimming in a kind of amniotic syrup and just kind of with Uber Eats delivering us our bug slop or
right,
whatever.
Right, but you know, as my friend JJ Charlesworth tweeted to much acclaim, it's like, you know, there was no lockdown. There were middle class people sat at home while working class people bought them things. You know, I mean, it's not that you can't technologize enormous numbers of things, even in a modern country. It's like, what are you going to do about like people who actually have to build things, make things and look after people physically? Yeah. Like, you know,
I mean, I suppose in that sense, you could say it's the same fantasy as the fantasy where you can have an economy entirely composed of knowledge class people, where nobody actually makes anything.
There should be very few knowledge class people. They are useless and irritating. And really, you know, what good do they do? I mean, my brother said to me once, you know, when I was teaching philosophy, he said, "You're paid to make people unhappy." And it's correct.
Brutal, but kind of true.
It's correct.
I suppose another way of another counterpoint might be, you know, that no, the people who come and do my course are unhappy anyway. I'm just paid to give them more better rent.
Philosophers shouldn't be paid. It's fine.
Yeah. but I mean, you do it for free anyway. Exactly. Not making people unhappy philosophizing.
Yeah, I know. It's fine.
But yeah, I mean, it's sort of the similar. It's the same fantasy in a sense, isn't it? The idea that we can just have robots bringing us stuff. And that there are no actual working class people required to take the bins out or whatever.
I mean, we'll probably have a really, really unstable fusion of like mass immigration, basically essentially a human slave class and a kind of robot slave class, you know, basically.
I read a really interesting article recently about delivery robots in Milton Keynes, which I hadn't realised that's a sort of city scale experiment that they're doing at the moment with these little robots that sort of cluster. They're like sort of animated autonomous Lime bikes that hang around outside shopping centres waiting to be commissioned to trundle off and deliver people. And apparently they deliberately make them cute so that if they get stuck or fall off a pavement or, you know, stuck in a pothole or something,
smash them to pieces.
people don't freak out.
Sure,
and
they
smash
will
them
anyway.
To pieces.
But I mean, it's just like this question of time. It's like, what are we saving time for? What exactly is it that people are doing with all this extra time they get from not making food or picking up things in the shops?
Well, you say that, but you will prize my washing machine from my cold dead hands, Nina.
I mean, I think we wash our clothes too much. No, but there is a kind of serious metaphysical, existential, you know, religious question about what time is for.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right? What is time for? What do we want time for? To spend time with our family, to read books, to worship God, to contemplate?
Are we okay? Like, let's drill down a bit then. Are we talking Kairos or Chronos here?
Well, I mean,
but that's kind of the point, isn't it?
But I think you can make every moment. I mean, every moment is meaningful, right? So, in that sense, of course, there are things we have to do, right? If we have to make money to pay rent, for example, one should internalize that as a meaningful reality that one must attend to.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's true. If you're the kind of person who will make meaning everywhere, then you're going to do that no matter what. And in a sense, it doesn't matter if you're washing your clothes by hand.
Yeah,
I mean, if you in theory, I sort of mentally write articles in my head while I'm vacuuming the stairs. This is not unusual. It's good. I think particularly if you're a terminal overthinker, to have something to do with your hands. I don't disagree with that. However, you will also prize my washing machine from my cold dead hands.
Sure.
And I think this probably just speaks to, you know, my own sense of ironic complicity in a lot of the things that I critique, you know, which is it's uncomfortable, but it's also just something to a degree, it's something that I just accept. In that, you know, yes, I can critique capitalism and I can critique, you know, I can unpick the relationship between women's liberation and labour saving technologies. And you can trace the history of that through the Industrial Revolution and the emergence of the women's movement as an effect of all of those sociocultural changes. You can do all of that. And yet, I think to a significant extent, where we are is a revealed preference. You know, not for everybody, but yeah, I mean, if I was serious about wanting to be, you know, a fully paid up crunchy person, then, you know, you can do that. People do that. Yeah, I don't want to do that.
No, sure. And I don't think it's like best understood at the individual level, right? There are millions of things we didn't choose, right? The world we're born into is basically like almost none of it is up to us. Of course, we have choices. Of course, our choices are meaningful, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, you know, we inherit enormous numbers of things that we had nothing to do with, right? Including technology, including the language we speak, you know, and so on, right? It's not that we're contingent, right? Of course, we're completely necessary, right? And ancestral and historical and all of those things. But it's like, I don't know how to put it, like the world we, I suppose it's like, what is the world, right? What is the world? How meaningful is the world, right, to us, right? Is it all that there is? And I think for a lot of people, it is all that there is, right? And so when we think about things like wealth and social status and all of those sorts of things, right, these things are often very meaningful to people because they signify something. They're like, I'm the kind of person who, you know, has this or does this. But of course, for example, you can have great taste and be extremely poor, right? We know this, right? And you can have lots of money and have no taste at all. Quite common, actually.
Many such cases.
So there clearly are things, right, which are not worldly, not directly measurable, quantifiable, and so on, right? I'll get back to washing machine.
No. I'm following.
Yeah. But it's sort of how to put it. I suppose it's like if we have our love in order, right? Like this is the interesting question I think about that was J.D. Vance raised this, right, in relation to sort of generic charity. I mean, this is one of the big discussions within Christianity and without actually about politics, like where we place our love. How far does it extend? You know, in relation to a kind of proximity and kind of concern for all, right? Do we want everybody in the world to have a washing machine? Yeah, in principle, right? Wouldn't that be great? How are we going to do that? I mean, clearly one way of doing it would be to kind of like neo-colonize the world and say, right, let's do this again. And you can have all of our secrets of technology and we'll build it for you and you can stay where you are and keep your traditions. And, you know, but nobody's going to do that, right? Nobody wants neo-colonialism. I mean, China probably is doing that in Africa, right? So the other solution is like, right, okay, we redistribute as much as possible in place, in situ, right? We sort of redistribute people, I suppose. And then kind of we have a sort of more or less equality of the worst, right? So everybody has less, but more people have small amounts of things, right? But this is still a very like material model of the world. This is like a world of stuff, a world of things, right? It doesn't tell you anything about a kind of higher purpose, right? But if you sort of, I suppose, ask yourself like, what the order of your love is, right? Do you want a washing machine so you can spend more time with your daughter or thinking about things or reading, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. So there's a reason for that love and for that time,
I mean,
and that attention.
In theory, I could be thinking while washing clothes, mm-hmm. but I quite like reading as well. And you can't really do that while you're washing clothes.
No, exactly. I mean, or you could say, well, I can't be bothered to wash my clothes particularly well. I'll just do it in 5 minutes. Fine, what does it matter? Or something, you know. You can make all kinds of decisions. But I suppose it's like, you know, as a country or as a nation, right, I think it feels like we've forgotten what we're for, what we're doing.
I mean, everything that you've said in the last 5 minutes is really stuff that goes around the God-shaped hole, isn't it? Mm. I mean, that's in a sense what we're talking about without talking about it. Is, you know, what actually is the moral order in the context of which all of this stuff is, without which none of this stuff is worth even really attempting at all. I mean, What in fact is the moral order within the context of which all of us or everything that we do makes sense, you know, in the light of which we take moral decisions, we prioritize our loves, you know, what is that moral order? And I mean, and there are, I think I agree with you that's we have to get that part of our house perhaps,
right,
in order before anything else.
If everybody did that, then we wouldn't need a state, right? If you think about it. Right. If everybody had their love in order and everybody was able to look after the people to the extent that it was possible around them, right? And that may mean kind of giving things to people who can't look after themselves. And we do this already for children, you know. And I think one of the demographic crash is a real thing. The bottleneck is coming, it's here. But I think one of the main reasons is like, what people don't know why they're having children. I mean, if you think the children are a gift from God, you're much more likely to have children, yes or no? I mean, clearly, right? So, I mean, people are like, well, why should I, right? This is going to take away my time, detract from my pleasure. I'm going to have less money. You know, if you see things in a purely worldly way, right, a purely utilitarian way, like none of it makes any sense.
You know, it's very difficult to explain to people how much fun it is telling stuff to a curious 9-year-old if they've never experienced it.
Right, exactly. And people will just see it in terms of like very blunt measures, right, which don't capture anything of the reality or the experience or the meaning.
So in the context of where we are and the country that we live in, you know, for really, really a very long time now, that sort of it's just been taken for granted until comparatively recently that that moral order was Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it probably, you know, to a significant extent, it still is, you know, with the possible exception of some post-industrial urban areas. To a significant extent, you know, that still is tacitly the moral order of Britain, even if that's now in a very secularized way. And while you're talking about getting your loves in order and getting and you know, we're thinking about this world and the next world and what's time and, you know, what actually matters and how much do these material things actually matter, it occurred to me that there's a sense in which Christianity comes with a unique challenge in that point of view, in that sense, because it's fundamentally an incarnational religion. So you can't just say, the physical world is meaningless.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a whole Albigensian crusade about that exact point about 1,000 years ago, and a lot of people died. And, you know, it's considered a major heresy to say we should just dismiss the physical world. Mm-hmm. You know, that's Gnosticism. You don't do that. Or at least not supposed to do.
No,
that.
I mean, how acts in the world. I suppose it's like saying,
and yet, you know, it's there in the Gospels as well that you should render unto God, you know, what's God's, and you should render unto Caesar what belongs to Caesar. And you know, and I think perhaps also the church, or certainly the Anglican Church, has grown a little bit. I don't want to say complacent, but you know, we've perhaps stopped interrogating ourselves too closely on what belongs to God and what belongs to Caesar, and that's actually gone in both directions, in the sense that the church has sort of nationalized a significant chunk in this country, at least, of her former caregiving functions, is a point you made earlier, you know, through all of those welfare activities which were once the province of the church and have always historically been the province of the Christian church, have become functions of the nation state and are funded through general taxation, you know. And in a sense, that was the point of the nationalization of Christian ethics, and also a radical driver, I think, of secularization, because in a sense, you know, it separates charity from worship.
Yeah. Totally.
So in a, you know, God and Caesar there have become muddled up in some quite significant ways. And I think you could probably also make the case that there's a real tension there in terms of the church's involvement in all of the now acutely political questions around, for example, migration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where it's absolutely part of Christian doctrine, and very, very clearly and rightly so, you know, that, you know, kindness to the stranger and welcoming the stranger, and there's the parable of the Good Samaritan, and there's also, again, that message that the Holy Spirit is for everybody and does not discriminate by nationality, you know, go and make apostles of all the nations. It's all right there, right? But it's less clear that it follows from that the church should be in the business of agitating for an end to national borders, or even what the relationship should be, properly speaking, between a state and a liberal modern nation state. You know, all of that stuff, I think, is much more is treated as though it's settled, and I wonder if actually we've arrived at a point where those are discussions which need to be reopened. Because, I mean, in a sense, again, you know, I'm coming to the end of this rant, but it was a fight over the proper extent of church and state, which really began the modern nation state era, wasn't it? I mean, the 30 Years' War at the beginning of the 17th century was about, you know, it was a power struggle between between Protestant and Christian denominations across Europe. But it was very much more complex than that, and it was very much more politicized than that, and it was about the consolidation of peoples and borders into the by and large the settlement which we've lived with ever since, and which people now treat as though it's self-evident and eternal, but really it wasn't. I mean, it's about 500 years old, and I think it's been, yeah, the ruling classes, certainly of the developed world, have been acting as if it was functionally abolished in 1945. You know, and just didn't bother to let their electorates know. And all of these, and this is intensely bound up in how people understand the relationship between church and state. And I feel as though these are all questions which are, if they haven't already been reopened, it's probably about time they were. But I certainly don't have any of the answers, and don't feel theologically qualified to go much further into it.
No, but I think there's a way in which everybody understands these questions, right? The extent to which, you know, the world is all there is, for example, one question. The question, what is a nation? Does it have a specific people or a history that is important to maintain? If not, why not? You know, those kind of questions. I think everybody is asking those questions, right? And,
yeah,
and
I
agree with you
right.
that they're unfinished theological yeah. and historical questions. They're probably never going to go away, right? Because how could they? But I think it's not to say that the world is nothing. I suppose it's like to say something like the world is not all there is, and that there are things that are sort of more meaningful than the things that the world presents itself, you know, as being meaningful, right? So if we think that like wealth and status are the most important things in the world, I mean, that's what the world is, like, that's all there is, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's a sort of very, very limited view of what matters.
I mean, I suppose my sort of mild note of optimism is that I think we may be reaching the end of trying seriously to immanentize the eschaton in the sort of...
Will always try to do that, though, that because people will always be unhappy.
Or at least the idea that we can use bureaucracy and technology to realize heaven on earth seems to be coming to a fairly abrupt and ugly... Or, I mean, it's been a long, slow, painful end, but it sort of feels like we're in the kind of late stage of anyone seriously thinking that that's plausible. What do you think? I mean, hopefully.
I mean, you know, on the one hand, I would like things to... slowly and without violence improve for everybody insofar as that is possible.
You don't sound very convinced that...
I mean, of course that's what everybody would want. Everybody, you know, ideally, for every living human being, one would want people to flourish and people to I don't know, explore every possibility of their capacity to be human in every different respect, right? That's what ideally we want. And this is why communism is so attractive, right? Because in a sense, it says that's what communism is. It's that, basically. It's a kind of polyvalence. It's free time. It's a world in which everybody's needs are met, and there is difference, but it's kind of dealt with in a sort of collective way. Of course, in reality, this isn't what happens, right? So, but we can take things from different bits. And I think, you know, the question of like whether Christianity has become communized is an interesting question in practice, right? Like, are these kind of Christian organizations basically behaving in quite a communistic way? Kind of, in some ways. I mean, maybe it's sustainable. Maybe it's fine. We can just keep going. I don't think so. I think... like the welfare state will collapse, for example. You can't have so few productive people. And we know, for example, in Britain that a lot of young people are leaving, right? Because they can make money elsewhere and get jobs elsewhere. Why would they stay? To fund things that they don't approve of and have more of their wage taken from them if they can work elsewhere. And that's not good. That's not a good sign.
It's not a good sign. I mean, I think I'm perhaps less bearish on the prognosis for England than you are. Perhaps because I don't live in London. I don't know. I walk through Woodlands every day, and yes, there are the aeroplanes go overhead, and then the headlines on my phone are what they are, and there's plenty of reason to be pessimistic, and yet. And yet the hawthorn still flowers.
No, but don't get me wrong. But that's why would I want to defend the country if I didn't think that was true? You know what I mean? If I was a nihilist, if I'd be just like, you know, oh, it's over, right? But it's not. I mean, Britain remains Britain. Like, everything we love is still here. You know, I don't want people to leave, but I understand why they are.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to be okay.
Okay,
I really do. I think we're going to make it. But I also
live in a very poor part of South East London, so maybe my daily experience is quite different.
I don't know. but it's possible that it'll be a bumpy ride, and it'll come out the other side of all of those systems unwinding that we began this conversation talking with. Perhaps it'll be a bumpy ride, but I think we're going to make it. I think
me too.
The other day I went to Buckden Tower, which is sort of it's sort of nowhere little place up the A1, but I think one of Henry VIII's wives was shut up there for a bit. It's a Catholic centre now. I just went for a walk around there with some family members, and there's an oak tree out the back there, which is the trunk is about as wide around as the studio that you and I are currently sitting in. And it's been there. It looks like it's been there even longer than Buckden Tower, which has been there since Henry VIII. And I looked at that and I was like, no, actually, England, the oak trees remember more than we do. And I think we're going to be all right.
Yeah, I agree.
on that mildly optimistic, sort of qualified note of optimism.
Nature
will be fine, and we'll have to do a rematch, Nina, to talk about the repaganization, depaganization, or consecration of nature.
Absolutely.
In the meantime, thank you so much for coming. This has been so much fun.
Thanks, Rory.
If you think these conversations are valuable, would you do us a favor and please like this video and subscribe to this channel? When you do that, you help us get these conversations out to a wider audience by telling YouTube that people are interested in this. Also, you can go to SocratesInTheCity.com, sign up for our newsletter, and you can check back every week. There's new stuff here every week. Thank you for tuning in.